what Paul is doing in 1 Corinthians 1 is two things. First of all, he puts clear blue water between the gospel and those values. God has made foolish the wisdom of the world. So he's by no means saying, you just keep going in the way you're going and you'll get to the cross, you know. You're half wise, Greeks, become fully wise. He's not saying that. But then he also says, the foolishness of God is wiser than human wisdom. So you want real wisdom, you Greeks. But if you're serious about searching for wisdom, you will only find its fullness at the cross. And so he's both subverting these cultural values and showing how they're fulfilled.
Hi, everyone. I'm Joel Lawrence, and I serve as the president of the Center for Pastor Theologians. And I've just finished a conversation with Chris Watkins, who is senior lecturer in French studies at Monash University in Melbourne, Australia. And he is the author of Biblical Critical Theory, How the Bible's Unfolding Story Makes Sense of Modern Life and Culture. This book won Christianity Today's Book of the Year in 2023. And it's a book I thoroughly enjoyed reading and benefited from, and really, really enjoyed this conversation with Chris. One of the things that strikes me is that he's in an academic context. He's a lecturer in French studies. He's doing the kind of thinking about the gospel and the church and the culture that we really value as the CPT, as we think about pastors being those who have a critical role in forming the theological imagination of our congregations, the narratives that we're living by. And I think Chris's work has been is really helpful. So would commend you grabbing this book and hope you enjoy the conversation. Chris, welcome to the podcast. Great to have you with us.
Lovely to be here, Joe.
Yeah. So Chris has written a book called Biblical Critical Theory. We're going to dig into that book. It was won lots of awards in 2023, and grateful to have the opportunity to talk. But before we dig into the book, Chris, would you just give us a bit of biographical background of who you are and your educational journey, where you're located now in your current context?
Absolutely. So I'm a Yorkshireman, born and bred, and I'm married to a wonderful Australian lady. So we're now living in Melbourne, Australia, where I work at a university lecturing in French studies down here. I wasn't a Christian growing up. I was a happy atheist, very content in atheism, no God-shaped hole, no huge existential crisis or anything like that. And I became a Christian around the age of 14, 15, largely due to the influence of a couple of key friends at school who invited me along to church. And it took me quite a long time to work out that I couldn't make sense of Jesus in the Bible. He did very wise things, like teach profoundly healthy ways of sort of thinking about the world. And he also, very inconveniently for me at the time, said some very silly things as well, like letting people come to the conclusion he was God and not correct them. And there were people who taught wisely and there were people who said silly things, but they tended not to be the same people. And so I really didn't know what to do with him. And eventually I came to the conclusion that he indeed was who he said he was and still is. And so I went up to university as a Christian, as a relatively young Christian, studying a lot of philosophy and literature and loving every minute of it. You know, the medieval night and the 19th century sort of ennui and tiredness with the world, and then early 20th century, you know, we're going to make everything wonderful, and then the World War comes. And so all of this sort of cultural history and trying to make sense of it as a Christian, I guess. And that's been really what I've been trying to do ever since. I went through a PhD and then a postdoc, and now I'm lecturing. I'm still trying to make sense of how other people make sense of the world and how they try and work out what on earth, you know, this life is that we're plunged into the middle of, and what, how to live it well.
We were talking before I hit record about some common history that we have. We overlapped in Cambridge and went to the same church and had very similar influences, but I don't know that we knew each other at the time, but we were both influenced by a man named Mark Ashton, who was the pastor at St. Andrew the Great. How did your university years form you, and how did your being in that church and sitting under that teaching form the way that you think about the world?
Well, let's start with Mark Ashton.
Yeah.
He, I think, was a huge influence on very many people who went through that church at the time. Largely because he really, and this is one of his own phrases, he believed what he believed.
Mm-hmm.
So he could have had a very glittering public ministry. He could have gone around the world speaking at conferences. His grasp of the Bible, his ability to articulate it, and his rhetorical skills were amazing. Mm-hmm. But he didn't. He knew that God had called him to be a pastor of a local church, and that's what he sunk his life into. And I think one of the things that really marked me from being under his ministry was the way in which Christians think about the world differently to the way that not all non-Christian people, but a lot think about the world. So it's not about how high you climb. It's not about how many people know your name. And it's not about what you get invited to. It's about being faithful to God and being able on the last day for him to say, well done, good and faithful servant, which I fully believe it was Mark Ashton's destiny. He was by no means a perfect man. And I'm sure those who were closer to him than I was would have known that. But he profoundly marked many of us by the humility and the focus of his ministry. He knew what he was called to, and he did it.
Yeah. He passed away Good Friday, 2008, I believe it was. And I had my wife and I had been there just the year before, and we had lunch with he and Fiona, and we continue to talk about him to this day. And so I'm grateful for the opportunity to memorialize him in our conversation. I just agree with your lovely tribute. He really was very influential on so many. And he knew what he was as a shepherd. And that was a tremendous impact. So you were a undergrad at Cambridge. You did your PhD. You're a lecturer in French studies now. Tell us about the French studies background and how has that influenced the way that you think and engage with the world?
Well, my undergraduate degree was French and German, and I loved philosophy. And there was a lot of opportunity to do philosophy and literature in the undergraduate degree. And when I got to PhD level, you have to choose. You can't really do both French and German. And I was fascinated by the mid-20th century French philosophers, you know, the people who often get called postmodernists. And partly because they have they think about things in a really deep way. They try and take nothing for granted. And they take seriously the idea that they're trying to make sense of the world. And it's a hard thing to do. And I've always found a kinship between that sort of deep questioning and a Christian position. Not in the sense that these philosophers and Christians come to the same conclusions about life, or they think that it means the same thing. But they're two of the small number of groups in society today who are still asked the big questions. I think the default position is not to go there, or to assume that it's too hard or too divisive or too political, and therefore to go through the whole of life never stopping to ask those fundamental questions. What's the meaning of life? It's almost a cliched, it's almost a comic question now, isn't it? What's the meaning of life? But Christians, I think, well, certainly the Bible takes it seriously, and Christians ought to if they're reading the Bible properly. And these philosophers took it seriously. And I think that was part of why I was drawn to study them in particular. And I guess part of why I was drawn to Christianity, that these questions are fundamental. And if that we all have a working hypothesis, don't we? We all have a functional sense of the way the world is. And even if we can't articulate it ourselves, we live our lives as if something is the case. Mm-hmm. And the only option is, are we aware of the way that we're living? and what makes sense of it? Or are we just letting other people decide it for us and going with the flow? And I guess Christians and philosophers are two groups of people who are saying, well, no, I want to think about this for myself. I don't just want to go with the flow.
That takes us nicely to your book, Biblical Critical Theory, How the Bible's Unfolding Story Makes Sense of Modern Life and Culture. I'm always fascinated to hear the backstory of a book, kind of the genesis of the idea and how, you know, the gestation process, the writing process. Take us through the background of the book. When did you first conceive of writing it? And as you were writing it, what were the goals that you had in mind of what you were seeking to achieve through the book?
It went through many stages, I guess. The first inkling that ended up being this book. So I didn't have this book in mind, but as an undergraduate, I wanted, as a Christian, to engage with the philosophers that I was studying in a way that took them seriously, which doesn't mean agrees with them, but tried to engage with them at the same level that they're writing. So a lot of the Christian writing on postmodernism that I found was tended to deal with sort of cardboard cutout versions of the philosophers. And similarly, actually, the philosophers, whenever they talked about Christianity, dealt with a very strange Christianity that I couldn't recognize from anything that I'd ever experienced. And so there were these two groups that really just didn't understand each other at all. And I was looking around for a Christian treatment of these philosophers that would remain thoroughly and richly Christian, but nevertheless would understand what they were saying. And I couldn't at the time find it. And so I thought over time, well, perhaps I need to try and write it myself for my own benefit so that I can make sense of these things from a Christian point of view. And over time, a couple of jigsaw pieces slotted in place, I suppose. One was when I first came across Augustine's City of God. And then I realized, you know, you're climbing up this mountain thinking, how do I make sense of these philosophers? And there you see Augustine at the top, like that's what he did. So he did for late Roman society what I was fumblingly trying to work out how to do for late modern society, only a lot better. It
was Chris, sorry, when was that you came across City of God? Was that in your undergraduate years still, or was that afterwards?
Look, I don't remember exactly. I remember where I read it. I read it on holiday in Bridlington, in the lovely Yorkshire seaside town of Bridlington. It's one of those books you took with you because, oh, look, you know, I probably ought to have read this. I'm not going to enjoy it, but, you know, let's just get it read. And it blew my, well, some of it blew my mind, but most of it just went over my head. Like all these names of Roman heroes, like, who are these people? But the bit that I did understand was just mind-blowing because Augustine was, in a sense, you know, light years ahead of me trying to do what I was doing. And the way that he did it was that he told the whole Bible story, creation, fall, redemption, consummation, in the second half of the City of God, and used that as a series of lenses through which to understand the tensions and contradictions and weaknesses of late Roman culture. And so from that point on, that was the model. The way to engage, I felt, with late modern culture was through the Bible storyline. And it's proved a really rich way over the years to do it, because I think the danger in a lot of Christian cultural critique is that we have our favorite passages or even our favorite doctrines. And so some of us will try to predominantly read culture through the doctrine of creation. And then you get a very affirming, way of reading culture that's quite close to the culture. And some of us will read it through the doctrine of sin, and it's all denunciation and look what's going wrong in society. And it's not that either of those is wrong in itself, it's that they're so partial. And what Augustine is doing brilliantly is he's letting every moment in the Bible story, or at least most of the significant moments in the Bible story, have their say on his cultural critique. And I just think that's a much healthier, richly biblical way of doing it.
Why do you suppose we're so prone to that partial critique, locking into creation or fall or new creation? What is it about kind of the way that Christians engage culture that might lead us in that direction?
It'd be interesting to ask a psychologist, I think. I think part of it is temperamental. We all have a certain disposition towards the world. Some of us are fighters, you know, attack dogs, bulldogs. And I think a way of engaging with culture that goes hard on sin appeals to that sort of temperament. You know, let's be clear, let's really, you know, expose culture for the cesspool that it is. Some of us are reconcilers. Some of us always like to find the common ground and, you know, start with a friendliness. And I think engagements with culture that are based on creation play to that temperament. So part of it is temperamental. I think part of it also is that it's just a little bit easier and quicker. And it's really hard to bring the whole of the Bible story to bear because there's a lot
of... Makes for a long book, doesn't it?
and there's a lot of nuance in there. And I'm not suggesting, you know, that we're frightened of nuance and dumbing it down. But I think there is an attractiveness to saying, look, this particular passage, you know, let's do Acts 17 or, you know, let's do Genesis 1 or whatever it is. And it's lower hanging fruit to be able to engage with culture on the basis of that one passage rather than trying to, you know, take into account the whole Bible, because in a sense you can never stop. You know, you always add layers of complexity to, you know, the Bible story that can be articulated as simply as creation, fall, redemption, consummation. But, you know, that is the beginning of a conversation rather than the end of one. You know, you need to... Don Carson is really good on this in Christ and Culture Revisited. And he has this long list of moments in the biblical story that cultural critique should engage with. And it is a long list. You know, he's going into Abraham and the Exodus and what have you. And it gets really complex really quickly.
So I imagine you've probably been asked about the title a number of times in these kinds of conversations. Biblical critical theory, obviously in the American context, critical race theory has been significant point of conversation over the last few years. I'm curious if you could just give us some of your thoughts on what you mean by biblical critical theory. How do you understand what critical theory is and how it ought to function in Christian engagement with culture?
Let's start with a distinction between critical theory with capital CT and critical theory with lowercase. Because I think the tendency, and you'd certainly get this impression from listening to the news, is that the capital letter version is the only version out there. And this is your critical race theory. So when people talk about critical theory today, most often they mean either simply critical race theory or what's often called the Frankfurt School of Critical Theory, which is, you know, Theodor Adorno, Max Horkheimer and others, who early on in the 20th century were trying to take Marxism and read it not as an economic doctrine, but as a cultural doctrine. And this is where we get the term cultural Marxism from. And to draw out of Marxism a critical view of the status quo in society that advocated for emancipation from what they saw as the oppressions in society. And for some people, that is simply what critical theory is. But it's not true that that's the only thing that critical theory is. So, for example, I did a unit as an undergraduate called Modern Critical Theory, and it wasn't all about Adorno and Horkheimer. It covered a whole range of thinkers. I think Julia Kristeva was in there. Simone de Beauvoir might have popped up. There was Derrida, Foucault, people like that. And so there's this broader sense of theories sort of, if you want to stick a pin in a timeline and say when it started, probably Immanuel Kant is as good an idea as any, because he has this fundamental shift where he becomes critical about the limits of knowledge. So he's very circumspect about what we can know about the world. And that critical turn is fundamental. And the second sense in which these approaches to the world are critical is in the sense that they don't think that the status quo in society is good. And they often critique the way things are from a particular standpoint that they bring to bear. And sometimes it's Marxist, not always. Foucault didn't really have a kind word for Marx at all. So it's broader than this narrow sense of critical theory. But it has in common with it a sense of the way things are isn't good in society. We've got a better vision. We want to critique the way things are and show how they might be better.
One of the ways that you do that is through what you call diagonalization. And I'd love to hear you talk about what it is that you mean by diagonalizing, how you employ that in the book for folks who haven't read it. How does that kind of function as a methodology for you as you think about critical theory, as a biblical critical theory?
It's a word that describes something that I think Christians have been doing ever since the New Testament, actually. And all I'm trying to do with the word diagonalization is put a label on it so it becomes visible in a way that, you know, if you don't name something, it's hard to sort of point to it. And so I don't think diagonalization is anything new. I think it's right there in, well, let's start with Jesus and his ministry. Hmm. So it's curious, isn't it, that often Jesus sets his view of things in opposition to two other views. So think about the Sermon on the Mount. Don't be like the Pharisees. Oh, don't be like the pagans either. Hmm. Yeah, both getting it wrong. Do it this way. Hmm. And what he's doing there is he's showing that society sort of splits itself in two, if you like. It doesn't have just one way that it gets things wrong. It lurches to both extremes. So either it's hyper-legalistic or it's this sort of free-fall of paganism. Or think about the prodigal son parable. You know, is the father like the younger son or is he like the older son? Well, the whole point of the parable is that they're both getting it wrong. Like the younger son is really insulting to the father and squanders the money. That is not good. The older son is really bitter and can't rejoice in someone who repents, and that is not good. And the father, if you like, is cutting across that really objectionable choice. There's a sense in which some of the aspects of what the younger son is doing are really actually quite good, like coming back to the father in repentance, not trying to bargain with him, saying, I know I've stuffed up, I need to repent. That's good. And some things that the older brother is doing are good. Like, for example, he takes his responsibility seriously and he doesn't go and squander the family inheritance. But you can't just simply say, oh, let's then take a bit of the younger son, a bit of the older son and smooch them together and then you've got the father. The father's attitude transcends the son's. And so that would be the way in which diagonalization works its way out in the Bible. You see it in Augustine as well. Perhaps if I use one example just to put some flesh on the bones of how it works in our society, that might help listeners a little. So think about the beautiful doctrine of the image of God in the Bible. And whatever we can say about it, perhaps we can say these two things, that it both exalts human beings in the, of everything in the whole created order, only humans and all humans are in the image of God. Wow, that's amazing. But it also humbles human beings because it reminds us that we're not God, we're the image. We rely for our identity on one who is greater than us, in whose image we are. And so there's this beautiful harmony of dignity and humility. And then you look at modern anthropologists. What do modern anthropologists do? Well, one way of trying to pass them out is that one trend is that it's all humility and no dignity. So you'll get people today saying, you know, we are fundamentally animals, just like the others. Slight differences here and there, but no fundamental difference between humans and animals. And all throughout the modern period, you've got people saying we're just fancy machines. There's no difference between human beings and machines. And that captures something of the createdness of us, you might say. You know, we're not God. We're part of the creation, not the creator. But it massively overplays that card, and it twists and distorts the biblical idea of humility. And then another trend within modern anthropology is to basically put us in the position of God. And this is what John Milbank argues in the opening chapters of theology and social theory. So what does God traditionally do? Well, God gets to self-define. God gets to say, I am who I am. I'm the one who says who I am. God gets to decide what's good and evil. What are the ways in which we think of human beings today? Well, the whole idea that I get to say who I am is really prominent in our society. The idea that I get to self-define, and the idea as well that I get to say what's good and evil, that I get to decide the meaning of my life for myself. Those are not fringe ideas today. And so you can read modern anthropologies as saying you're just a machine, oh, and also you're a god. Now, you know, go and live your life in psychological sort of balance, trying to keep those two ideas together. And to diagonalize that from a biblical point of view is not to say, well, let's split the difference. Let's say we're half machines and half gods. How about that? Is everybody happy now? Well, nobody's happy now. It's to say both of those are distorted and partial versions of a beautiful, harmonious truth that manages to keep those two together, which is the image of God. And so to diagonalize them is to get past this false dichotomy between you're a machine and you're a god to the beautiful symphonic truth of the image of God. And in that sense, you might want to say it's the image of God is the first way. That's God's original truth. And it's been butchered in modern society. And what we need to do is get back to that first way, cutting across the false choices that we're offered today.
Yeah, I found this so helpful reading the book, because it really does keep us from the danger of kind of falling into a squishy third way in which the terms are set by the structures of the world as they are presented to us. The terms are set by that which we can see rather than that which we don't see. And I thought that your way of working through this diagonalization was very helpful in giving some handles for how to think about really how does the transcendent claim of the gospel enter into and impact the way that we understand the world around us and live in this world. And that leads me to a question. Obviously, over here in the United States, we are in an election year. And one of the instincts in the American Christian psyche is to read our country's history as oftentimes, to put it bluntly, as biblical history or continuing biblical history. I'm curious how you think about, according to your view of biblical critical theory, how do we read God's actions in historical events? What are the dangers of reading God's actions into particular contingent historical events? And I wonder if you might be willing to comment to pastors in the American context as we're navigating political waters today about how to shepherd our flock in this time.
I'm reminded, going back to the beginning of our conversation, of something Mark Ashton used to say, which I found incredibly helpful over the years. I think he was preaching through the book of Revelation, and he said, and this was his understanding of what Revelation teaches, is that the end point is very clear indeed. We know how things will end up. There's no ambiguity about the final things, in the sense that, you know, the devil is cast into the lake of fire, Jesus wins, his people enjoy eternity with him. The next step on the journey, he said, is much less clear. And exactly what God is doing in our own day is not something that we're given 2020 vision about. Yeah. And the way that he tried to conjugate that was to say it's like riding a bike. If you look down at your feet, you're likely to fall off. But if you look ahead at the horizon, you'll keep your balance and you'll keep going. And so I think that a healthy biblical approach to trying to work out what God is doing in the world is precisely, as he said, to keep our eyes on the horizon. Mm-hmm. Because and in a sense, there's nothing unusual about that. You know, it's Stephen Covey's Begin With the End in Mind, isn't it? It's the good advice of life coaches. Like, you've got to keep the big picture in mind to know how to act in the present moment. And there's a sense in which it's no different to that advice. Don't obsess about precisely what's happening at the moment. Keep the big picture in mind. Remember how it finishes. Keep your eyes on the horizon and keep pedaling.
As you think about where Western Christianity is in this moment, as you think about the pressures on Western Christianity, could you comment on what you think are some of the kind of pressing needs of the moment for the church? And obviously you're in a different context than I'm in, but maybe paint with some broad strokes. What do you think are the pressing projects before the church in this time and in our engagement with culture, in the shifting world around us? What would you encourage us to be thinking about as those who are shepherding the church?
Well, I would need to preface my answer by saying that I'm not in a full-time paid ministry context. I'm a university lecturer. So my view of the church and the pressures it's facing is obviously colored by that partial perspective that I've got. So let me begin with my own neck of the woods and then try and broaden out a little beyond that. I have found incredibly helpful and productive and salutary for Christians to try to do for our own society what Augustine is doing in the City of God for his, which is bringing the whole biblical story to bear on the whole of society, and in John Milbank's terms, out-narrating it. In other words, telling a story about the society around us that is actually more compelling and more revealing about that society than the story that it tells about itself. And I think in terms of cultural critique, that is a huge need and a huge opportunity of the moment, because the stories that late modernity is telling about itself are not terribly convincing ones, and they don't join in the middle, and they pull in different directions a lot. And so, and that's not, I don't want to come over as sort of saying, you know, therefore Christians need to say, gotcha, you know, and look at the silliness of late. No, there's a lot of Christianity in late modernity to begin with. You know, it's a complex picture. So it's not a triumphalistic critique. Yeah. It is walking alongside the culture, seeking to serve it and love it, and that sometimes means pointing out contradictions. More broadly speaking, I guess the Christianity that I've been most blessed by has been a Christianity that has managed to keep the main thing the main thing, so keep the Bible central, and engage with political issues without getting sucked into political categories that are dictated by the world. I'm thinking of people like John Stott here. So, you know, a thoroughly richly biblical outlook, you know, and in sort of issues facing Christians today, he's dealing with the hot button issues of the day, but he's not getting sucked down a rabbit hole of remaking Christianity in the image of a particular political ideology. And when that's done badly, it is this sort of wishy-washy third wayism. But it's not always done badly. And I don't think John Stott does it badly. I don't think Tim Keller does it badly either. It can be a really robust way of not letting yourself be captured while bringing the Bible to bear on the different political ideologies of the day. And I guess that's a need in every generation. And so I'm pretty confident in saying it's also a need in our generation.
So you think about the goals of a Christian critique of culture. What are the goals in your mind? Is it to renew the broader culture around us? Is it to call the church to understand potential ways that it's conformed to the culture? As you think about where critique goes, what is the fruit that you hope is born by Christian cultural critique?
I'm trying to think of what Bible passages to bring to bear on that question, and three immediately come to mind. 1 Corinthians 1, Acts 17, and Romans 12. So what Paul is doing in 1 Corinthians 1 is what some Christians have labeled subversive fulfillment recently. So he's saying, look, there are these values out there in society. Greeks, you love wisdom. Jews, you love miraculous signs and power. And then he does two things. And I could talk for hours about this. This is just the most amazing passage. And it's been such a blessing to me. sort of lean into this passage in Cultural Critique is just phenomenal. So he did, first of all, he puts clear blue water between the gospel and those values. God has made foolish the wisdom of the world. God comes in weakness, the cross is weakness. So he's by no means saying, you just keep going in the way you're going and you'll get to the cross. You know, you're half wise, Greeks, become fully wise. He's not saying that. There's an antithesis. But then he also says, the foolishness of God is wiser than human wisdom. And let that word wiser sink in. So you want real wisdom, you Greeks. You need to come to the cross. I know it sounds stupid. I know that sounds the least likely place to ever find wisdom. But if you're serious about searching for wisdom, you will only find its fullness at the cross. And so he's both subverting these cultural values and showing how they're fulfilled. And I suppose there's a ministry there both to Christians, because of course he's writing to Corinthian Christians. He's not directly addressing the Jews and the Greeks here. Like Christians, you know, you be confident. You see how the gospel fulfills and subverts the values around you. And there's also a message to those who are searching those values. You know, God has made foolish the wisdom of the world. You're not going to find the fullness of what you're looking for if you keep looking for it in the way that you are. The second passage, Acts 17. So Paul is critiquing the culture around him there, I guess, with the aim of showing how it does, in fact, and again, you know, in a way that scandalizes a lot of the people that he's hearing to, it does show the need for God. And there are some moments where the Greeks have a sort of a faint sense of the way things are, you know, that in him we live and move and have our being. Paul says, okay, that's right. But there's also a point at which the Greek culture can't grasp the truth, you know, and particularly when Paul starts talking about the resurrection. You know, people mock him. And yet there are some who end up believing at the end of that passage. And then again, I think there's a ministry both to Christians and to those who are not Christians in that passage. And then finally, so that this answer doesn't go on for too long, Romans 12, you know, don't be conformed to the pattern of this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your minds. What is the pattern of this world? Well, if we don't ever think about the ways in which the society around us is catechizing us and shaping us in a particular way, it's very hard not to be conformed to it if we've no idea what right. It is. And so I think there's a ministry to Christians there. Look at what society is nudging you to assume. And I think this is true in ministry as well, isn't it? You know, there's the caricature would be, we think of Christian ministry as some sort of a CEO of a company, and your job is to grow the company, or we see it as a political activist organization, and you know the objective is to change policy. And there are other models as well. You know, don't be conformed to any of those models or the subtler versions of them, but recognize them, name them, and be transformed by the renewing of your mind. So I guess the short version of the very long answer I've just given would be, there are lots of different things that this cultural critique is doing, both inside and outside the church.
I think that's a great word of encouragement for the pastors who listen to this podcast. We talk a lot about the pastoral role in forming theological imagination at the Center for Pastor Theologians and really equipping pastors and encouraging pastors in that role. So I want to thank you for the time that you've given to us today to have this conversation. Thanks for the gift of your book. I would encourage the folks who are listening, if you haven't had a chance to read it yet, to grab Chris's book. I thoroughly enjoyed reading it, learned so much from it. And again, just want to thank you for joining us today.
It's been wonderful, Joel. Thank you ever so much. If I could just encourage people, check out Mark Ashton's sermons on the St. Andrew the Great website. Just Google St. Andrew the Great. Check out Mark Ashton's sermons. There's a rich, rich treasure in the way that he expounds God's word.
Amen. I agree. Thank you. Take care.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the CPT Podcast, a theology podcast for the church. If you appreciated this episode, could I ask you to consider sharing it online with others, rating the show on Apple Podcasts, or even leaving a review? It means a lot to us, and it helps others hear about the show. The CPT Podcast is a production of the Center for Pastor Theologians. You can learn more about the CPT by visiting us at pastortheologians.com. You can also find us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. Today's episode was hosted by CPT President Joel Lawrence. Our podcast producer is Seth Porch. Our editor is Trenton Jones. Our music was composed by Andrew Gerlicher. I'm Zach Wagner. Thanks for listening.